This is the AWS Podcast. I'm Jeff Barr. As part of the Intel Startup Spotlight, I'm speaking with Charlie Walton of Funders Club. Welcome.
Hey there.
So give me a brief overview of what Funders Club is all about.
Cool. So Funders Club is a venture capital platform. We have three types of users that we work with generally. On one side, entrepreneurs, also investors, and then we actually now operate funds for other angel groups and VCs as well. I can spiel on that in a second. But our goal is to leverage software and our own networks to bring a great fundraising experience to entrepreneurs. So like fast, a lot of transparency, high touch, and then also allow investors, accredited investors, to get exposure to venture capital as an asset class.
Okay. Could you explain for our audience what an accredited investor is?
Yeah. Accredited investor. It's a lot of different countries have a definition of it. It's a income or net worth requirement or like professional association entity requirement. It's essentially a way for the federal government to say like, we trust you to invest in private companies.
Yeah. So the sense I've understood is like, that you understand as an investor that you know what you're doing and that you can invest and that your returns are going to vary wildly and that anything
exactly.
can happen. And
here,
it's not like putting money into a savings account or
totally,
something like
exactly.
that. There's risk involved.
It's in the U.S., it's sort of like prove to us that you have enough money to invest such that if your investments go to crap, then you'll still be okay.
Exactly. So what was the original thinking behind the company? What was kind of the goal of like, okay, if we can do this, then the world will be better because?
Yeah. Alex and Boris, our founders, went through YC with the vision of an online venture capital firm. And that brings together a whole lot. There's sort of structural differences in the way that we operate and manage funds that are sort of specific to the venture industry. So like, the way that we collect money, the way that we invest in companies is a little different. And then there's also differences in the way that we interact with our founders and the process that we want to provide them. And then there's a larger vision, too, around being able to open up the platform to a much broader swath of the population. So, like, tackling each of those a little bit. Typical VC firms have limited partners that provide them with the capital that they invest. Those limited partners are larger capital holders, so people that can afford to put millions, tens of million dollars aside and know that they're not going to be able to touch that money again because it's in a liquid class. Things like endowment funds and pension funds and sort of like big players that move slow. We saw an opportunity to tap the internet, tap technology to, rather than go to those partners to raise money, we look to accredited investors. So we say, like, rather than taking one $10 million check, let's take 10 $100,000 checks and do that all on the internet. So remove geography, remove timing, remove, like, being there in person, like, writing a check. On the investor side, we work with smaller players that that can move quickly. On the company side, Alex and Boris both had experience fundraising for previous companies, and venture is famous for its opacity or lack thereof, I would say. The anecdotes of entrepreneurs who get bullied or misled, or an investor is like, hey, oh, I'm just trying to convince my partners, XYZ, blah, 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 and 2 weeks later, everything falls through. Like, though venture funds some of the most exciting companies out there, venture itself as an industry is pretty old school. It's a bunch of people sitting in a boardroom, like, making decisions. There's not a lot of data out there.
All with the same basic background and outlook on life.
Exactly. Focused in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. So in that sense, when you really get into it, it seems like an industry that could benefit a lot from a fresh take.
Okay, so really a service both to the startup companies, giving them better access to capital, and then service to the potential investors, making it perhaps easier for them to invest more modest amounts of money in promising startups.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Exactly.
So if I'm a potential investor, let's say I'm accredited, I simply hand you a big chunk of money, or do I have some discretion as to what happens next?
Yeah, totally. And this is one of our one of the things that we've enabled by doing this all online, which is going back to the original venture model. When an LP forks over a bunch of cash to a VC, they don't know how the money is going to be used. It's not like the VC can find a bunch of companies and then bring them to the pension funds, and the pension funds get to decide. Like, that whole process just moves too slowly. For us, though, since we work with much smaller players, people that are in more direct control of the capital they want to invest, we actually get to source companies first and then present them to our members, who individually get to opt in. So if you want to invest along a certain, I don't know, industry, or have a certain hypothesis, or international versus local, you're empowered to make those decisions.
So if I wanted to invest in, I don't know, media and entertainment, or online financial services, or gaming, or infrastructure, I would have some choices within different industries.
If you want to, we are constantly surfacing single company investments. So if you log on, you can see like of company X, company Y, they look good, let me review their deck, I'm in. We also offer a more structured vehicle for people that want more instant diversification. So invest once in a themed fund. So we're looking at fintech companies, or we're looking at the summer 15 Y Combinator class or something like that. You put in a check there, and that then gets distributed among 10 or so companies. And that's a really great way to, without having to micromanage anything, get a really good broad exposure to a certain theme.
Okay. So once I've done this, I have a view online into my cash position and my investment positions.
Absolutely. You go in, you can see what companies we've invested in. We work closely with our entrepreneurs to ensure that as they do investor updates, we pass those along. You can go in and manage your investment portfolio, see how your returns are doing. It is an illiquid asset class, so you can't take your money back out of the company. Meaning that from an activity perspective, we aren't the stock market with daily changes. Being said, though, that also is one of the most exciting parts about the asset class, is that these are young companies, and as an investor, our platform enables us to help you help the company. So if you have expertise in a space, if you have introductions, the platform really aligns everyone, us, the entrepreneur, the investor, so that we all want this company to succeed. We all want this investment to do well. And with the, say we bring 50 people into a fund, those people might know people that can bring introductions. And we have countless examples now of our, I think 10,000 strong, over 10,000 now, group of investors saying oh, I know someone at that oil and gas company, or oh, I know someone in the thin films, X-ray chromatography space, or whatever. I don't even know if that's a thing, but
sounds very promising.
Yeah, exactly. Being able to sort of tap the network of our investors is something that has really started to differentiate.
Okay, so the investors actually get to share their expertise and not just fork over their money.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what we really want.
Interesting. So if they have knowledge of and interest in a particular industry segment, they can invest, and then they can, to a certain degree, maybe even influence and steer what might happen there.
Exactly.
What kind of time horizons should people think about? They put money in, and then they're thinking years or decades, or what's the kind of the thinking that they should have?
Years, definitely. We've had on the platform now, we've been alive for 3 years and 2 months. We actually put out a 3-year infographic, a little cool web page if people can find it online. And we've had half a dozen exits at this point. That's one perspective on the cadence. Obviously, the biggest exits, things like IPOs, take the better part of a decade to unfold. Yeah. So it's definitely not a class you want to invest in if you are looking for short-term returns.
Certainly. Now, have you done all the legwork so that investors from anywhere in the world can do this, or is this more focused on just the U.S.?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We love our international investors. It's both on the entrepreneur side and on the investor side, we have a real international presence. So actually, the aforementioned anniversary site really calls out both the countries that we have investors in and the countries we have companies in. So we've done, whether it's investing in Germany with money coming from somewhere in Asia or something, we've got people everywhere. The experience is really solid. Our legal documents and stuff, which all are done online, you can participate in the Silicon Valley venture scene from anywhere in the world.
Okay. Now, from the entrepreneur side, at what stage of their fundraising process do they typically approach you, or do you approach them, or does it come through incubators or VCs?
Yeah, it's really all of the above. We have excellent relationships with incubators and some accelerators. So the 500 Startups Y Combinator is like, we, Funders Club itself went through Y Combinator and still like love that network. We're very active at demo days. It's one of the more popular investment vehicles that we offer. We're also close with lots of other incubators, hardware, software, bio, like pretty much anything here. We have like a pretty well-defined set of criteria that we look for. So though we are seed stage, we're not like super early, I've got an idea stage. We actually, like, companies can apply online and it sort of walks you through exactly the criteria that we're looking for. So in that sense, we try to be super upfront about like, hey, these are the types of companies we're looking for. If you're too early, like we have a huge CRM of our own company. It's like, we do not forget about people. And so like, there are tons of examples of like, you're too early right now, but we think your idea is super promising. Let's talk in 6 months. 6 months later, we talk, numbers are on point, we make it happen. Similarly, we're also now really starting to participate in later stage rounds. So we've followed on and had pro rata in companies through A's and B's and C's. So it's though we started small, we're also starting to invest much larger checks.
Okay. So if I'm an investor and I invest in like a seed round for a particular company and things are going great and they go through an A and a B, do I get an opportunity to put additional funds in there to keep up? And
yeah, that term is called pro rata, and generally it means like if you acquire X percent of a company every time that they have another fundraising round, you can reinvest capital to achieve that X percent again.
Okay.
And this is a the relationship with pro rata is something that's really evolving. It's something that, like, depending on the state of the market, whether we're in an entrepreneur-friendly market or an investor-friendly market, whether there's lots of cash or things are tight, pro rata is one of those things that can get negotiated for. So some investors really fight for it. Like, they really want to make sure that, like, if they're in early, they can maintain their holdings. Some don't. We love pro rata. And, like, our business side works very hard with entrepreneurs to come to term sheets that grant us it. It's not something that anyone can guarantee, but if we look at venture as a whole, there's been changes to Y Combinator that have suggested the way that they participate in pro rata with their opportunity fund recently. There's lots of other great podcasts talking about the role of pro rata in negotiating. So like, we, whenever we can, get pro rata, and we actually have a really strong track record there, and we offer it, yeah, absolutely, to our investors.
Okay. Now, do you track over time as these companies get their second, third, and subsequent rounds? Do you kind of try to capture their valuation and kind of use that so when I look at my portfolio, I can get the sense of...
Absolutely.
Of potentially on paper, of
totally.
Course, you know, with all understanding of that this is all paper until there's a liquidity event.
Absolutely.
I can see what I might have.
Yep. It's one of those things where, like, we want to be careful, so we don't. If some company says they're doing well, like, we're not gonna take it upon ourselves to go in there and click up their valuation.
Sure.
But if they go on to raise another round, if they have a new 409A or sort of like a more formal valuation by a third party entity, if these other big events happen, we absolutely use that data and say, well, here's what your investment is currently worth, and that there's a whole like portfolio management My Investments tool that you can go in there and check it out.
All right, I'm long overdue for actually starting to participate, so
it's cool.
It's on my list.
Cool. It's even if you don't end up committing capital, to come in and really realize that you can get close to the metal now. Like, venture, it's easy to live in the Bay Area or just care about startups, and everyone talks about entrepreneurs fundraising and like these big rounds they get raised, but oftentimes we don't actually know how any of it works. You know, we just see some TechCrunch article where it's like, company raises a bajillion dollars. But in the end, like, these are just, there's a certain subset of like legal terms you'll come to know and like financial investment like mechanisms that you come to know, and like after a while, you're like, oh, this is just how this business operates.
Yeah, so a bit more visibility, a bit more transparency, and some maybe investor education as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about the technology stack that powers all this. So what's there?
Totally. So from day one, we've been a software company, like a VC, absolutely. That's our business model. But technology is awesome. And like whenever we have a problem, whether it's like a soft touch problem, a high touch problem, like an engineering problem, a data problem, like we love throwing stuff at it. So like as an AWS customer, we have like a VPC with, you know, two or three RDS instances at this point, a bunch of ElastiCache things, EC2s, like a pretty like awesome setup for us. You know, mm-hmm. like we are a super high leverage engineering team, so like we really love paying for things. You know, like we want to focus on solving like brand new problems, like problems that no one else can solve because no one else is writing software for venture capitalists. So whenever we can, we look to great SaaS companies, Amazon, to say like this is a hard engineering problem. You guys have solved this super well. Like we want to use you. And it is a perfect example of that. So our entire site runs on it. Like we have from a data perspective, we're in a sort of interesting place. On a day-to-day basis, we have millions of dollars moving through our system, internationally, domestic, in checks and wires and online ACH transactions. We have very sensitive documents with social security numbers and EINs and all sorts of like legal documents on that side. We also have just like very confidential information about the companies that we're working sure. with. And that means that we are a very defensive, very service-oriented company when it comes to sort of our software architecture. So like we have at this point half a dozen sort of standalone systems that each do like, I'm the server that handles identity verification, and like all of you go away. Like, same thing with payments. Same thing with sort of.
So isolated and well-defined tasks for the different servers.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Do you have to deal with encryption and things like that?
Yep, totally.
Well?
So like making sure everything's good in rest and in transport and stuff like that. It's been awesome to see. Like that's a hard problem, and it's definitely one of those things that it's exciting now to be able to build systems and leverage the work of the entire engineering community to like build these really bulletproof systems without having to write a ton of low-level stuff.
So, okay. What are like the other like components of your technology stack? So we talked about EC2 and RDS and VPC, languages, frameworks, things like that.
We're pretty much a Python shop. I'm trying to think if we have any other like random scripts or anything. Pretty much not. We like recently played around with spinning up something on Node, and we're like, man, we like. Yeah, our main app runs in Django. We have a couple of separate services that also use Django or some other like random Python web frameworks. RDS in the backend is all Postgres. Our front end story is getting better. We've now started incorporating Angular for a long time. We were using like a homegrown backbone handlebars thingy. We've migrated from a bunch of sort of custom Python controllers to serve as like a fake API, there's like air quotes going on, an API layer to like a much more formal, much more attractive sort of REST interface. That's as we've split off services into their standalone, we've been using like REST APIs to communicate between those.
Yeah, certainly a lot of the people I talked to yesterday and today, they're all telling me very similar stories of like, regardless of whether they expose services externally, it's like microservices on the inside as you know, thoroughly and pervasively as possible.
It's just great. And it's one of the things I love using sort of new and shiny, or even if it's just like, you know, I was noticing in like the Django 1.8 docs, like they'll introduce new features, you know? Like sometimes it's small, sometimes it's big, sometimes it's like, oh, we added a decorator, make this easier. Like one really, like I was watching a great talk from like PyCon talking about like coding style, and like being consistent is so important, you know? And like when you're opening it, when you are like looking at your crazy models file, it's 1,000 lines, like you want to do it the way previous models have been written, just so like a new engineer community can understand it. But that also means that like you can oftentimes like peg some of your most core components to like 1.5 when you're on 1.8 now, you know? You don't get to use the new and shiny. And one of the sort of surprising benefits that I really enjoyed of like spinning up these new microservices is that like it gives us a new opportunity to be internally consistent within that system. So like we'll be like consistent in our payment system or an operation system, but using all the new and shiny.
Okay, so each of these little services is like a little bubble universe that's entity unto itself that doesn't have to worry about being version compatible with the other microservices because they're each in a nice little environment of their own.
Yeah, and like nowadays with all of the sort of like SaaS continuous integration tools, like it's really, we will sort of have this one-to-one mapping of like repo and GitHub to like build system. We use Circle CI. It's been great for us to sort of like build and ship stuff, and then like defined infrastructure on the last component, and like that all sort of just works, and it allows us to introduce new factors without introducing sort of like chaos into the old world. And yeah, it's just really, it's really cool. Like,
so you can then, cool you can say, okay, well, we're going to use 1.8 features for the new service. We've got the old one on 1.5, but then you have to have that note at some point that says, let's not let it get too old and too crufty. We need to, you know, separately move it forward, but you can do that without risking the other things.
One of the things, too, that we do is, like, we are very much a... one of the weird things about working in venture is like there isn't a lot of software for it, meaning that when we're designing features for our platform, there oftentimes isn't like a user to talk to. There isn't like a well-defined like, oh, this person here is going to do this. Like, no one's been able to do this before, and so like, you know, like if you had been an LP at a previous venture, you'd never think to come online and check up on your portfolio. Mm-hmm. Like, you've never had that ability before. What that means, though, is that, like, it's tough for us sometimes to develop empathy. Like, what is the most important problem that we should be solving next? And what that will oftentimes mean is, like, we will 80-20 it, as we say, which is, like, we will ship something to sort of see if there's fit there. What that can mean, too, is, like, sometimes things aren't built perfectly. Like, sometimes it's better to just, like, get it out to the market, get data for a couple weeks, see how people are using it, like... We will oftentimes, for our most successful product features, like, ship a version that, like, no one's super proud of, but, like, within days or weeks, we know it's worth it. Like, we see that it has traction. We get responses from users. We get responses from entrepreneurs being like, oh, that was awesome. That was so something like that. We'll then live with it for 6 months or something, and we'll really come to realize, like V0 of this solved this problem. There's a bigger problem here, and it's sort of this, like... Let's not, like, we'll bug patch that little thing that we ship there, but, like, maybe leveraging microservices, maybe just, like, building this into a separate part of the system. Like, let's take that V0 and let's have V1 be something brand new. Like, let's design it from scratch to be a better architected solution.
And you'd incorporate all the things you learned during the life of the V0. Okay.
And nowadays, with the pace of, like, framework changes and the like, I mean, I look at some of the front-end problems we solved in Backbone and in the Angular world, those things, you just don't even think of those. Like, yeah. So, and every time we get to do that, as I'm trying to say, is like we can move even faster because the tools we get to work with are that much better.
Excellent. So. Are your users good at giving you feedback and saying, this works, this doesn't work, I'm confused here, I don't understand why this is 17 steps and it should be 2?
Totally. It's, yes, in the sense that, like, everyone knows that unhappy users are vocal and like people are screaming and yelling and stuff like that. We don't have a lot of user fire drills in that sense. We will have situations in which like we have the benefit of like we can jump on the phone with our investors. Like we are a very high touch company when it comes to the relationship with our investors, with our entrepreneurs, with really everyone involved. And so in that sense, like we incorporate their feedback like very closely into our product development life cycles. Being said, we also have a unique perspective though, which is like when we think about problems, like we bring our like software hammer to the table. And so we've noticed that like sometimes the feedback we get from our users just like isn't even thinking big enough. Like they'll like see something and be like, oh, I want this like in like I want this in like this graph form, and like we're like, we need to build a whole portfolio manager.
Sure. You're always thinking one more level of indirection and saying, we're not just going to solve that point problem. We need to solve the whole class of problems for this user and for all the users to come.
And sort of extending to sort of more broader product development, like we've also, as a company, gotten more mature around understanding like what are our archetypical users. Like the people that come in and only want to choose their single companies, people that want to just come in and be able to easily diversify into 20, 30, 40 companies to get good exposure. Like not everyone thinks about venture the same way, and people have different budgets, different allocations. And so understanding those users' needs, being able to sort of distill those to help us build products and features that solve everyone's needs. And then of course, like for us, a huge component of every feature or our product that we build is legal and compliance and all this stuff. I mean, Funders Club has a long legacy of pushing the envelope. So like if you Google like Funders Club SEC, like the entire underlying structure that we operate on that enables us to build an online venture capital platform didn't exist before us. Mm. So like we actually wrote a letter to the SEC, and there's something called a no action letter. So like we were the first online venture capital firm. And like now there's a bunch. It's like super validating. It's a thriving industry right now. But every time we do something, like the amount of legwork that the fund op side puts in, legal side puts in, like it's hard to know. Like when we're building a screen to manage and see the valuations of your investments, that's like super sensitive information. And that's information that like we've had to solve some really hard problems with, you know? Like we don't want to spread misinformation. We don't want to like discourage investors from investing in certain segments. There's a hard problem that's in my mind that I think is probably too complicated to explain.
Yeah, you need to disclose everything that you've got, but you don't want to like go scarier than usual.
That, exactly.
It was interesting as you were telling me about that. I remember reading a book about entrepreneurship years and years ago, and they kind of classified kinds of companies you could start by degree of difficulty. And I think on the far right hand of the scale said, like, if you need regulatory changes, that would be like the most difficult. And it sounds like you've actually had to go there.
Exactly. I mean, that was a core component to the way we launched. And it's like what it has enabled for us, both currently and then in the future, is huge. We had an intern recently that said huge nonstop, so that's like part of my vocabulary.
I like that.
There's the capital, there's lots of cool sort of presentations out there right now about this. Andreessen Horowitz put out one recently. It's like companies are staying private longer and longer. More of the value that gets created when a company grows is happening while they're private. So, you know, like 10 years ago, a company might IPO at one valuation, and then over the course of their public lifetime, they might grow 10x, 100x, whatever. Today, we're having companies like Twitter IPO, where they're IPOing and then they aren't 10xing or 100xing. Like, if you want to participate in a lot of the growth that we're seeing nowadays, you have to get in at the early stage. But right now in the U.S., the mechanisms for enabling that are dated, are pretty crappy. Like, they just don't exist. The same way that we can all take out, like, an IRA or a 401k and, like, get our Vanguard, like, index funds or whatever, like, that doesn't exist yet for private equity.
Yeah, during the dot-com boom of, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, the big deal then was like to get in on all the IPOs.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd work with your broker and they would get you allocations of, you know, 50 shares or 100 shares, but then you were locked up with them and you had to actually keep them so you'd stay in good graces with your broker, and it was fairly risky actually. And you could have it and say, you know, I'm not sure I really believe in this for the long term, but you're kind of stuck with it for a while.
Yep, totally. So when we look at the we talked about accredited investors, and that was like a big step function for the industry, you know, going from like a couple LPs to accredited investors. But when we look at the long-term vision here, like building a vehicle that's as easy to use as the like Betterments and Wealthfronts, the like the really well-managed services now, like we really want to be able to enable like everyone to get to participate in all the growth that's happening at the private stage. And like tying this back to the regulatory stuff we're talking about, like so does the government. Like I think the SEC is like on our side in this sense. Like we're clearly adding value. Like this sometimes we still get concern around like you guys are doing what? Like on like we've never heard of that. We don't like know that model, or like we'll be involved in a Series A or B, and the lead investor will be like, I don't know, you guys are like atypical. Like there's not a lot of from my perspective, it seems clear that like we're creating a huge amount of value and it's recognized by institutions big and small. And so like I think in 10 years we'll look back and wonder like, why weren't all VCs operating with technology?
Sure.
Or whatever, so.
Yeah, the changes that are sometimes the most revolutionary, they're not visible until you're actually looking back and you say, oh, look, we've actually made a gigantic change, and when did that actually happen? And it's not always obvious beforehand that it's going to be that amazing, remarkable change. Well, it's been really enjoyable to speak with you. Any parting thoughts or anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to make sure that our audience knew about Founders Club? Or
no, I encourage everyone to check out our 3-year anniversary post. It's sort of cool just to get a scope of the numbers and stuff.
I will definitely do that. All right, well, appreciate you coming by.
Thank you so much.
This has been the 8OS Podcast. This recording is part of the Intel Startup Spotlight, and thanks for listening.